This evening we begin a new series of discussions, and our general subject is the orientation of Hermetic philosophy. In all of these courses, we are attempting in every way possible to present the material without depriving the student of the right to arrive at certain conclusions of his own. In other words, where certain reasonable doubts exist, where conflict or contradiction is present, we will say so, in order that we shall at least have solid ground as far as we can go. And in the case of the Hermetic philosophy, we cannot go as far as we wish that we could. In the first place, the entire origin of this field of thought is utterly obscure. All that we have is a group of definitely conflicting reports. But out of the conflict itself, and out of the very circumstances which surround the times and conditions associated with the beginning of the school, we gain some very useful and practical insight. So we will try to sketch the field first historically. It is generally assumed that the only material that we have relating to the general subject of Hermetic philosophy originates in the writings of the Ante-Nicene father, Clement of Alexandria. Clement's Alexandrinus includes in his work a considerable discussion of a system of Egyptian ritualistic, symbolical, magical metaphysics, which was prevalent at his time. And he wrote with the perspective of the late 1st and early 2nd century A.D. Clement does not, however, actually approach the central problem, namely, who was Hermes? Thus we have to seek in other directions, not nearly as factual or as comprehensive. The standard texts of the present time do not have any general knowledge of how what is called the Corpus Hermeticum came into existence. The corpus is composed or made up of a series of writings attributed to a mysterious person called Hermes, and often referred to either as Hermes Trismegistus or Mercurius Termaximus in the Latin form. Several efforts have been made to assume that this Hermes was the Egyptian deity Thoth, T-H-O-T-H, long associated with the concept of wisdom, and considered by many to have become intermixed with the Greek Hermes, particularly during the period of the Grecian pharaohs of Egypt. That is, the dynasty of the Ptolemies, the dynasty immediately preceding the beginning of the Christian era. There is no evidence of certainty, however, that the Hermes of the Hermetic school was actually the Egyptian Thoth. This, however, brings a further matter. Thoth, as a deity, was worshipped in Egypt for a very long time. It would be safe to say at least for 3,000 years before the beginning of the Christian era. The question naturally arises, then, was this deity a deified human being? Did a being or creature by the name of Thoth actually exist at some remote age. The tendency now has been to suggest or suspect that many so-called deities were originally persons, and that through long periods of veneration and infallibility, a kind of deification was given to them by popular esteem. Plato declares that there were at least five persons by the name of Hermes in the Greek system. Therefore, that somewhere along the descent of this name, it was bestowed upon persons. Now, two possibilities present themselves under this thinking. The first is that the original concept of Thoth as one of the five elder deities of Egypt was that he was a god, and like Osiris, was originally a divine being, the basis of a general worship, at least in certain provinces and areas of Egypt. That later, this name was bestowed upon certain human beings as a title of honor or distinction. They were given names to indicate that they were Thoth-like or Hermes-like. Also, there is something to recommend the idea that early writers, recognizing Hermes as the deity of universal mind, took the position that mind is the author of all works. Therefore, that behind the human author of every product is the universal mind, who might well, therefore, be regarded as the genuine compiler, writer, or editor of the work. Thus, a work could be dedicated to the universal mind as its true author. Thus, persons in many ages could attribute their own productions, particularly those of vision and inspiration, to a deity long honored and regarded. It might then well occur that as in other religions and in other systems, both inspired teachers were said to have arisen, becoming the embodiments or incarnations of the principle of wisdom, therefore entitled to bear this name. Certainly there were several persons by the name of Orpheus, as Taylor points out for us in his analysis of the mystical hymns of Orpheus. There was certainly more than one person in the course of time known as Zoroaster or Zarathustra. And it is quite possible that the last of the Zoroasters, who is said to have been personally known by Pythagoras, was by no means the first of these fire prophets, but was a distinguished philosopher or mystic or illuminata who had received this name as an honorary title. Thus it is quite conceivable that the name of Thoth, or Hermes, because of the peculiar sphere of influence over which this deity was said to rule, could well have been associated with human beings, whereas many other deities might not so readily adapt themselves to this process of humanization, or this process of perpetual or periodic re-embodiment. We then have another thought, which is rather daring, has not perhaps received too much consideration, but might be worth a second glance. Namely, that Hermes, or Thoth Hermes, the final person with whom we are concerned, was actually a ritualistic personification. In other words, that this so-called person was the symbolic impersonation of an idea, and that with the gradual passing of time, this person became real, although no one seemed to know where he came from, who he was, or how he departed from this life. if he was a person in a sacred drama, a character in ritualism, a hero signifying universal mind, or even human mind in its noblest and broadest sense, this person could become identified with a story. Ritualism could create a life for him, create situations, but these situations would be essentially symbolical rather than literal, although they might be very well set forth in a rather literal appearing relationship. That such may have been the case in the situation involving Hermes is not unreasonable, for we know that even Clement refers to the Hermetic system as broadly and deeply ritualistic. Wherever ritualism becomes important, we have this tendency for the emergence of a prominent or principal ritual personality who becomes the actual embodiment of the doctrine, the procedure, and all that has to do with a system of religious philosophy or mysticism. We know also that it is quite possible for imaginary or ritualistic persons to gradually gain historical definition. A good example, of course, is the story of the Count of Monte Cristo, who had no existence except in the fertile imagination of Alexander Dumas, the father. Yet even today, tourists are taken out to the prison where he was imprisoned, and his cell is carefully and faithfully shown to them. The fact that he never existed is of no particular importance anymore. Now, there have been a number of instances in which imaginary persons have so taken the public fancy that we prefer to accept them as factual. Now, this is on a secular level. If we add to this the aura of divinity, creating a mystery and framing within this mystery a transcendent being, there is every reason to assume that it might be perpetuated as an historical person. So we have, in summary, about three broad possibilities here. One, that we are dealing with a divinity representing a universal state of consciousness, and that this divinity simply descended into the Greek period of Egyptian philosophy and was regarded as the patron of a school or system. The second is that this divinity was represented by embodiments, and that therefore priestly initiates, teachers, authors, and scribes may have received this name and have therefore been regarded as this person. And the third, that he is a ritual figure, as we will find in many other religions and philosophical systems. With this situation, as broadly expressed as we can, we then come to the intricate problem of dating the Hermetic philosophy. Nearly always we must date a subject, particularly an unknown work, by context, by a study of the structure, by a study of the internal ideas presented. It is nice to assume that ideas can be born out of time, or that they can appear full born and full grown like Minerva from the head of Zeus. But actually, this is very rarely, if ever, the case. Every idea of man is set into a framework of time and place. The average person, and even the average highly informed person, cannot be totally unhistorical. He cannot have attitudes that are totally unknown to the world in which he lives. Nor can he develop an idiom or a form of expressing himself that is completely outside of the language structure of his own time. Thus, through idiom, through structure, and through various colloquialisms, forms in grammar, and other instruments, it is nearly always possible to historically establish a work within a very few years. An example of this, of course, a good example, is the early Rosicrucian manifestos. The Fama and Confessio Fraternitatis and the Chemical Marriage of Christian Rosenkreutz, these books are supposed to have been written much earlier than their date of publication. Actually, however, by studying them, we discover that no matter when they were written or how they were written, they could not have been written before the rise of Martin Luther, because there are certain ideas incorporated into them in certain patterns which did not exist or were not known before that date. Thus, the earlier dating must be regarded as largely mythological. Now, in the study of the Hermetic writings, as they are preserved for us, we are in the presence of certain elements or factors that cannot be denied. The first is that they do not represent the philosophy of the ancient Egyptian. They are not a bona fide perpetuation of the ancient Ammonistic doctrine of the principal Egyptian systems. They are not grounded or set in the Osirian cycle, or the great restoration of Egyptian religion, nor can we clearly find them oriented into the temporary reforms of Akhenaten. That these teachings are not classical Egyptian, we must finally accept, because our gradually increasing knowledge of Egyptian literature and a number of recent discoveries on the dramatic and ritualistic and mystical writings of the Egyptians, apart from their funereal texts, all these prove conclusively that the Thoth of ancient Egypt is not actually the Thoth Hermes of the Hermetic philosophy. We must come down to a more recent time in order to find the inspiration behind Hermeticism as we know it. There is every reason to assume from the text and the study that the works could not have been written earlier than the time of the rise of the golden age of Greek philosophy. Therefore, that the writings could not, in their surviving structure, be earlier than the 3rd or 4th century B.C. Also, there are other elements involved. Elements coming from the eastern side, indicating strong Oriental influence. And this Oriental influence is of a type which could not be any earlier than the golden period of Grecian thought, the so-called Age of Pericles. Therefore, assuming this to be the earliest possible date, and remembering always that the earliest known versions of these works are in Greek, we must also determine, if possible, the latest conceivable date. And knowing the quotations from the Hermetic writings made by the fathers in the 1st and 2nd century, we can say with reasonable certainty that this work, the Corpus Hermeticum, must have been compiled or brought together in a period of approximately 300 years, not earlier than the middle of the 4th century B.C., or later than the beginning of the Christian era. This general pattern will be subject to perhaps a re-estimation of 40 or 50 years, but I think not more than that. Actually, the Corpus Hermeticum consists of 42 books, at least it is so traditionally stated. Against this is the rather bizarre background in which it is affirmed that the writings of Hermes originally included 10,000 volumes. This, I think, again, must cause us to pause and assume that probably a symbolic meaning is intended. Here we have something to suggest Hermes as universal mind, the writer of all books. Even on this point, however, we must have a cautious attitude. because we know, enlisting the books of Plotinus, who came in a little later in North Africa, that the term book was not used then just as we use it today. It was used with a bit of the Saroyan quality, which was not so well known to antiquity, because some of the books of Plotinus do not contain over 1,000 words. They're comparatively short tracts, but they are still called books. Thus, we are not sure how much actual writing might be involved in the so-called mythological library of the size mentioned. The next point is that the number 42, to refer to the so-called authentic works, is a highly significant number. It is the number of the Egyptian assessors of the dead, the jury that try the soul in the field of Amentet. It is also the number of the provinces of Egypt. There were 42 nomes, or provinces, and that is why there were 42 assessors, one of the jurors being selected from each of the provinces or nomes and their celestial correspondences in the universe. Thus, the number 42 suggests high symbolism of some kind, and also reminds us that the phrenologists of the 19th century, for some reason quite unknown, decided that there were 42 faculties of the human brain. Again, a number appearing which seems to exhaust certain intellectual processes and reflexes within the human intellectual equipment. So we have to be a little cautious on this point, sensing the possibility that we are dealing with an allegory or a figurative concept of some kind, possibly even Kabbalistic. The next point in connection with it, of course, is that up to the present time, very few of the so-called original works of Hermes have been known. We will in a later discussion go into these books, but for our orientation problem, we might say that up to now, 42 works are not known. The principal work that is known today is the Pyamandres, or the Shepherd of Men. Outside of that, there are other short fragments, but the Corpus Hermeticum contains nothing resembling 42 books. Early writers came to the conclusion that it never did. But now we must also pause for a moment and mention the Kenoboscian find at Luxor in Egypt in 1946, when the discovery of a Gnostic library about 30 miles from Luxor also included within this collection of books several Hermetic writings not previously known to exist. This opens the door for the speculation that it is possible that 42 works did exist at one time, that there was a reason for this selection, that it was not entirely arbitrary, or if it was arbitrary, it was a division set up within a group of writing in order to indicate some important sequence or symbolism involved in the work itself. Today, the term Hermetic is perhaps more loosely used than any other in the field of philosophy. We may say that after about the 2nd or 3rd century A.D., this term became gradually the synonym of secret. Anything that was completely sealed, completely hidden, completely locked, was regarded as hermetically contained in some way, and we still use the term to signify a sealed vessel or retort. Actually, as time went on, the term was used in connection with practically every system of unorthodox thinking that developed in the Mediterranean and European theaters from the 3rd century to the 17th. Now, that is a long period of time. The word was thrown around and variously applied and misapplied for nearly 1,400 years. During this time, it certainly wandered far afield. A very large literature involving it arose upon alchemical speculation. It even became involved in medicine and in astronomy and in mathematical formulas of one kind or another. It came in general to represent practically the whole body of a secret or profound learning, particularly such learning as related to causes or to principles not immediately otherwise obvious or available. From this we must come to the conclusion that today it is exceedingly difficult to differentiate between the layers and overlayers of speculation which have developed around this theme. If we study the period most involved in the rise of Hermetic philosophy, say the period from the 3rd century B.C. down through and into the 1st century A.D., this period certainly stands out as a period of extraordinary mental activity. It also stands out as the beginning of the rise of sectarianism as it had never previously been known. And we must pause for a moment to analyze this because I think it is important to us. Our ancient forebears in the North Africa, the Mediterranean theater, usually had their own local religions. They had the religions of their provinces and of their cities and communities. Usually the city or community faith was based upon that of the larger geographical area involved. When a nation conquered another nation, it conquered the gods along with mortals and brought its own religion which superseded that of the people that had been conquered. Thus there was very little actual change of faiths due to sectarianism. People were not inclined to say, I prefer to worship this way, and you can worship that way if it pleases you. You worshipped according to the land in which you lived. And if anything happened and your land changed proprietors, then it was assumed that if your gods were not strong enough to preserve the country that they governed, then it was a good idea to change your gods and join up with the conquerors, and at least be on the right side of the situation. And as changes in the religions of peoples were very slow, and most reformations were of slight general importance, I think we can say that up to the beginning of this critical period, there was almost no concept of what the Shakespearean plays refer to as a misbeliever, an individual with a wrong religion. The only way you had a wrong religion was to be in the wrong place or to fail to change when some other religion took over your country. There were not minority faiths and majority faiths such as we know today, nor were there the 500 jarring sects referred to by Omar. These things simply had no existence. There was practically no tendency of anyone to say to another man, your faith is wrong, or your gods are unreal, or anything of that nature. That attitude was foreign to antiquity. Wherever the deities were strong enough to protect you, you worshiped them. And generally, the so-called state religion concept prevailed. And if you were within the state, you held to its faith. If you traveled from another country, temporarily, as a merchant or someone of that nature, and you came within the area of a deity different from your own, it was assumed that there would be a certain fraternization among the gods also. Your belief was held with respect, but it was very unlikely that you would be able to convert anyone to it in the new area. You were there as a guest. Your God was there as a guest of the local deities. And everybody expected everybody to take a nice attitude about the whole thing. All of a sudden, this changed. And changed in an extraordinary way. There gradually developed, in an incredibly short time, considering the motions of these days, a difference of attitude involving the total rejection of certain ideas as false and superstitious, the imposing of an entirely new group of ideas, and the division of peoples into schismatic groups, bitterly antagonistic to each other, and frequently ready to persecute and martyr the members of other faiths. This was a new and different situation. It arose with the changing of certain patterns, and we still are not too sure of what caused these patterns to change. But individuals living quietly within the atmosphere of their local gods did not change without cause. And this cause was not revelational. This cause was historical, social, and political. It had to be, because it had to strike into the lives of many persons of different minds and in different localities, in whose lives and thoughts such ideas had not previously existed to a degree that there is any historical record of them. Something happened, and we must begin to try to find out what did happen. One of the things that probably contributed very strongly to this situation was the rise of the Roman Empire. The Romans were the first great colonizing people of our knowledge. Also, they were the outstanding exponents of a way of life based upon commerce, exchange, and economic procedures. The Roman actually carried his religious philosophy more lightly than any other recorded ancient people. To him, religion was secondary to business. Of course, it's quite incredible that such should be the case, and we can hardly imagine it, although we're in exactly the same spot today. The Roman had his religious services, and he had his prayers, but he was perhaps the first man to pray for the inconvenience of his competitors. He very definitely invited the gods to work a hardship on anyone he didn't like. He also was perhaps among the first to pray for profit and for these material concerns, which were comparatively secondary in the religious life of ancient peoples. He was also confronted with a situation that perhaps disillusioned him, or on another way of looking at it, opened him to the modern attitude on religion. In the process of colonizing and conquering and extending the boundaries of his domain until the Roman, in his glory, controlled most of the known world. In this procedure, it was necessary for him to absorb, govern, direct, and integrate into the great pattern of the Roman political structure more than 100 different peoples. These peoples, each with their own religions. This was the first time that these various religions had been subjected to the domination of a comparatively unreligious people. Here we have an interesting situation, because we can no longer assume that the gods of Rome simply won the battle. The Romans took much more faith in their phalanx and in their trained military power and in their machines of war than they did in divine intercession. The peoples conquered did not find it, therefore, possible to simply worship the gods of Rome. Even the Romans could not tell them how to do so. Other than state festivals and certain broad concepts, the Romans had no religious substitute for the type of spiritual value which existed among the peoples that were conquered. At no time, for example, did the Roman have a religious philosophy as deep as that of the British Druids, although he conquered Britain. He never had a religion or philosophy as great, noble, or profound as the philosophies and religions of Greece, yet he became temporal master of Greece. Step by step, therefore, the world was bound together without benefit of the gods. Now the Roman was enough of a businessman to realize something that even we do not fully recognize as we try to gather around some such place of compromise and arbitration as the United Nations Council Chamber. The Roman realized that he could not profitably destroy the religions of all the peoples he conquered. He realized that to do so would be to destroy the social structure of the world. He therefore controlled the religion, but did not attempt to destroy it. And in the height of the empire, Rome, in its great edicts, declared universal religious tolerance. And at the time of the great Roman Forum, which was really the common ground of the empire, temples to many deities of many races and of many nations stood side by side with complete immunity from persecution. The Roman did not care what you worshipped, as long as you paid your taxes and kept out of treasonable activity. He did not care what your religion was, as long as you did not attempt to discredit the economic, political, military, or social power of the Roman state. Therefore, nearly all religious persecution in Rome was the result of groups or individuals attacking the Roman way of life. As long as they did not do this and simply maintain their interest in their own affairs, the Romans were not inclined to persecute in any way. And the proof of that is that nearly all of the great religious and philosophical teachers of the period, at one time or other, drifted into Rome, had schools there, and taught publicly without any interference of any kind. They taught many doctrines strange to Rome, but they paid their taxes and kept out of politics, and all went well. This, however, presented for the first time a situation that had never existed in our general thinking. The world, the Roman world, had the spectacle of many gods meeting on a common ground. The temples of many faiths, and to a certain degree, this proximity must have influenced Roman thinking. It must have caused the Roman, and later the members of other peoples that came to Rome for one reason or another, to do for the first time what you might call religious shopping. They began to look around. Instead of simply worshiping the conventional deities of Rome, they learned that a certain teacher was particularly outstanding, so they went to him. We know that because of their attitude, the Roman intellectual would go to the great teacher of rhetoric, regardless of his gods. That made no difference. But we can be quite certain that an outstanding master of rhetoric or philosophy addicted to other deities would certainly involve his students in his personal philosophies and religions as time went on. So we have the possibility, which did not previously exist, of the average person weighing gods against each other, trying to observe the relative values of things, and coming to the conclusion that this was deeper than that, or that was more shallow than this, and the possibility arose of the individual saying, I believe this philosophy or this theology is better than that. Previously, such comparison was comparatively impossible. This arose also in the building of Roman philosophy. And when we study the works of the principal Roman philosophers, as Marcus Aurelius Antoninus, the Emperor Julianus, and Cicero, and several of the other outstanding men of the time, we know that they were all eclectic philosophers. That is, they showed definitely that each one of them had trotted from one temple to another, and had gained something every time he stopped. And out of this religious circumambulation of the forum, He had come to a new kind of philosophy with a bit of Egyptian, a bit of Greek, a bit of Persian, and perhaps a few vestiges of old Roman lore, and a kindly thought for the Druids, or the Mithraic teachings, which became the principal religion of the Roman legions. During the period of the conquest of Britain, for example, the Roman soldiers were not even worshipping the Roman gods. They were worshipping the Persian Mithraic deities. The image of Mithras slaying the ox was the principal symbol, and the Roman soldiers left it in England by a little stream, and because of this statue, it was later called Oxford, and there the great University of Oxford was built, being built upon a monument, or in relation to a monument of a Persian god placed there by Orthodox Roman legionaries. Now you begin to see that we're in what might be termed a polyglot situation. Rome made possible, in fact made inevitable, that discriminating persons who previously probably had never visited far from their own lands were now able, within Rome itself, or in Alexandria under Roman control, or in Athens under Roman control, or in Antioch under Roman control, or Ephesus, all of these great polyglot centers being then Romanized politically, that they could go to these centers, or living in them, could enjoy extraordinary educational and cultural opportunities. That in any one of these cities, a dozen great teachers might be flourishing together, not as in Greece, divided by their arts and sciences primarily, but now divided in the total religion, philosophy, and idealism which dominated their systems. There is no doubt that without such a situation, Gnosticism, a polyglot belief, could not have come into existence. Neoplatonism could not have arisen to the condition of general recognition which it enjoyed. There would have been very little possibility of the ascent of Manichaeanism, which was another one of these polyglot beliefs, nor would we probably have had Hermetic philosophy. They all seem to be more or less involved in this pattern. We also find rising in areas under general broad Roman influence, such as Judea, the rise of the Essenian cult, later the Kabbalists, and in North Africa the Jewish sect of the Therapeutae. We find men like Philo Judaeus arising in this pattern for the first time, writing a work on religion in terms of comparative religion, in which, instead of deriving his total message from his own faith, he immediately began to use other faiths as means of explaining his own. This situation may be said to have broadly existed just at the critical period that most interests us. Nor can we overlook the fact that Christianity rose at precisely the same time, and that Christianity, as a structural faith, bore witness within itself again of a highly complicated intellectual, moral, aesthetic background, a background in which from the very beginning Christianity stood out against, for instance, the background of Orthodox Judaism. Here we have a faith emerging by a strenuous reform. Here we find this faith spreading almost like wildfire, extending through a highly conditioned society. Had Egypt, with its old gods, had its old impregnable position, had the ancient deities of Greece been firmly and completely dominant, and had the Latinized Greek gods of Rome had the strength and domination and complete authority that they had in the times of Numa, or even in the period of the first Caesars, we could not have imagined any polyglot or heterodox faith spreading through these areas without an immediate reaction that would have almost exterminated it. Instead of that, we find it reaching people who are already inquiring, who are already a little uncertain, who are already disillusioned in something. The great note of Judaism of the time was disillusionment. The ancient gods of Israel had not preserved their people from the tyranny of Rome or the tyranny of Herod. The old vows had been broken. The punishment of deity was upon a delinquent people. All these explanations, man's moral effort to avoid or evade the inevitable fact that as a sovereignty he had been defeated and enslaved. All this turmoil, all this increasing doubt, the power of Rome took away from nearly all these other peoples the absolute faith which they previously had in their own deities, and gave them no immediate transference of that faith to any other group of deities. And gradually, out of this confusion, appears to have arisen a kind of intellectual individuality, perhaps best represented by your eclectic philosophy. These people simply, as we said, went shopping intellectually, and they bought a little from this store and a little from that mart or shop. And they built together a philosophy based upon experience, justified by personal favor, and perhaps containing a beautiful assortment of partly digested inconsistencies, as in the very beautiful but not maturely organized meditations of Marcus Aurelius. Now, this perhaps is the answer, by a rather long roundabout road, but one that almost has to be covered, to the rise of the Corpus Hermeticum. It represents a natural instinct on the part of man, an instinct that we are feeling today, the instinct for the need for a substantial religious philosophy of life, an instinct that is pressed on by disillusionments, an instinct which is somewhat embittered, an instinct which has no longer the open-minded faith of the small child, but rather the disillusioned attitude of maturity. No longer this willingness, this readiness to believe all good things, but a certain suspicion, a fear that all pretenses conceal ulterior motives, or perhaps the continual fear of being hurt again, a further disillusionment involved in spiritual conviction. We know from the writings of Boethius and others that this disillusionment was strong in these early formative years of our modern religious life. If this can be regarded as valid, and we assume, as we must, that all old faiths did not die in their tracks. In other words, in these critical periods, a curtain didn't fall over the religions of the world, and all the old ways simply ceased by magic. It was reported that Great Pan died, but we have no proof that this actually happened. We only know that he was no longer to be seen playing on his pipes by the side of the river. Actually, Egyptian philosophy did not die. Greek philosophy did not die. The Druids did not die. They were perpetuated in England in the bards. They were perpetuated in all the later mythology and lore, such as the Arthurian cycle and the legend of Taliesin. All the old ways lived on, but they lived on with certain modifications and changes. And in many instances, they flowed together to form new combinations which lived, and the original patterns were no longer entirely distinguishable. We know, for example, that before the end of the 6th century, Egyptian philosophy in Egypt was virtually dead. By that time, Muslimism was beginning to come in, and in a short time, the land of the Pharaohs would no longer be Egypt. It would be an Arabic state in which perhaps only a few of the old Copt Christians held any real link to the past. Therefore, if Egyptian religion survived at all in Egypt, it survived in Coptic Christianity. And we have reasons to know that this is quite essentially true, for there is much evidence of the survival of Egyptian religion in the Greek Orthodox, the Russian Orthodox, and the Armenian Orthodox churches. So things disappeared into patterns and came out again much later. And because after this decline of the Roman Empire came the Dark Ages with almost complete illiteracy, a great deal that was carried across this long dark interval was born with half memory. People did not even know anymore where it came from. They had forgotten and did forget in the course of 400 or 500 years the entire cycle of descent. Little by little, the symbolism was moved into new patterns and imposed upon new doctrines until the original situation was comparatively forgotten. And today, if you go through a great cathedral or study the various parts and elements of Christian ritualism, you will find hundreds of relics, fragments, survivals of much older pre-Christian beliefs. But the average Christian believer does not even know this. Therefore, it is quite likely that he did not know it 1,000 years ago, even as well as he does not know it today. I finally made a sentence out of that, didn't I? Anyway, out of the polyglot of Greek, Egyptian, some Syrian, possibly some Hindu, and other Asiatic faiths, we seem to find two or three important groups emerge. One of these groups was most certainly the Hermetic. It is also interesting to observe that the early church fathers, the anti-Nicene fathers, anti now meaning before, not against, before the Council of Nicaea, the anti-Nicene fathers accepted out of the past two so-called pagan teachers with almost universal respect. A little later, they added a third. The first two that they accepted were Plato and Hermes. And the third, who became popular a little later, but retained his popularity beyond either of the others, was Aristotle. And by the rise of medieval Christianity, Aristotle was held in just about as high a regard as any of the prophets or patriarchs. Christianity became Aristotelian, whereas in the early part of it, it was essentially Platonic. But that these church fathers in the first, second, and third centuries should not have resented either Plato or Hermes is itself an interesting point. It means that they recognized in these systems certain truths or certain realities which could not be denied, or which were so stated that they could be Christianized to the benefit of the new faith. What then was the point, the basic point, upon which so much of this depended? And apparently, this basic point in both cases was the definition of deity. The Gnostics had an entirely different definition of deity, so they were almost completely rejected. The Neoplatonists, with their peculiar mystical approach, also found little favor. But the Platonists and the Hermetists found a very strong favor because of their approach to deity as a purely monotheistic being. Therefore, we must say that Hermetic philosophy introduces strongly, sometime slightly before or at about the period of the Christian era, a totally monotheistic concept of God. Now, this is interesting because it has been called a pantheistic monotheism. Not a polytheistic, but a pantheistic. In other words, the one deity of Hermes and of Plato was a deity within creation, not a deity outside of or brooding over creation. The attitude of Hermes is the same as the attitude of St. Paul, the God in whom or in which. And we are told that probably the original of the New Testament statement was also in which we live and move and have our being. Thus, the deity of Hermes was an all-enclosing spiritual principle. And this essentially is also the logos of Plato. Thus, the belief in one God seems to have endeared these two schools to the early rising Christianity, and to have caused the Christian church, particularly in the period of its great apologists,